This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The murders of 9 African-Americans at the Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina in June raised many questions about gun control, race relations in the United States, also the use of the Confederate flag. But it also sparked another debate about whether the killing should be considered an act of terrorism. How do we determine terrorism, and when do we call someone a terrorist? A new report offers a view on how law enforcement agencies across the nation perceive and label acts of violence. Charles Kurzman is a professor of sociology at UNC and one of the co-authors of a report. He is also the co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of Middle East and Muslim Civilizations. Charles Kurzman joins us on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks very much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the key findings in your research. You poll law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, we surveyed 382 law enforcement agencies from municipal, county, and state police and sheriff's departments around the country and asked them a series of questions having to do with the threats from violent extremism. And we were surprised, really, to learn that the most common threat that they indicated they were facing within their jurisdictions was threats from anti-government violent extremism, with over 70% of the agencies reporting that being one of the top three threats in their jurisdiction. Al-Qaeda-inspired Islamic revolutionary violent extremism came in second, under 40%, and third was environmental violent extremism within their jurisdictions.
This would be vandalism or acts of violence by environmental groups.
Yes, right. Yes, primarily acts against property.
All right, so that's the poll. And did you sort of give them the choices, or was it open-ended? How do you see the threat, or did you give them sort of categories?
We gave them a half dozen categories and also had an other category where they could write in what they felt, in their own words, were the biggest threat.
Kind of interesting to see this. So that these are anti-American groups that they see as, or anti-government groups that they see as the biggest threat in their jurisdictions. Do you have any indication how they determined this, how they figured out that that's the problem in their city or municipal or region?
So our research group did follow-up interviews with 19 law enforcement agencies, speaking with specialists there working in combating violent extremism. They indicated a variety of ways that they try to stay on top of these kinds of issues, identify threats, and work, obviously, to prevent them. And that includes following social media. It includes, of course, the everyday conversations that law enforcement officers have with various communities. And it, of course, it includes the acts of violence that they witness in their own jurisdictions. There's no single way in which they come up with these assessments, is our sense.
Do you have a sense then? I mean, it is interesting because I think when we use the word terrorism or threats of political violence, I mean, I think the first thing that comes to mind is internationally inspired, perhaps Muslim inspired or Islamic terrorism. The words go together as though they're hyphenated in a single word. Were you surprised to find that American or anti-American violence was the biggest threat to these agencies?
Yeah, anti-government was the category, anti-government violent extremism. And if you think about what gets the most play in the media and in public debates and certainly in political debates about national security and public safety, The threats from these Al-Qaeda, the self-proclaimed Islamic State, they're constantly recruiting through the internet to get Muslim Americans to engage in acts of violence. That's what gets all of our attention. But to see that law enforcement did not register that as wide a spread a threat as this anti-government movements, that was very interesting, I thought.
What about actual violence? How much do we know about who has done what in the United States?
There are a number of different accountings using different definitions for violent extremism, terrorist attacks, instance of ideological violence. And they show, according to the different types of definitions, that there's that anti-government and other forms of right-wing violence seem to be as great or sometimes in some accountings greater than the number of attacks that are inspired by Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State.
So what are these attacks? How do they register? Are we talking about homicides? Are we talking about property damage?
Both. I mean, to give an example, there was an incident last year where a fellow who had anti-government beliefs drove an armored vehicle onto a courthouse steps in Georgia, tried to take over the courthouse, was armed with a number of weapons, fired at law enforcement. They fired back and kept him from gaining entrance to or taking over the courthouse. I mean, that's a pretty spectacular type of violence. Yet it didn't become a national story.
Well, and that, I think what that comes down to is whether or not these are perceived as individuals. And then, of course, the next cut the media is going to make is whether or not this individual is perceived as disturbed or part of some larger, more coherent political group. Whether you agree with their politics or not, they may have a coherent message. Any indication at all how much of this violence does come from individuals and how much is more organized and more coherent?
I think we're seeing quite a bit from individuals in recent years. The organizations have been pretty much rooted out. It is difficult to maintain a conspiracy over a long period of time if you're going to be engaging in violence on that scale. But individuals have access to the ideologies online now of anything, of all sorts, and extremism is out there. Very few of the folks who engage in that, who subscribe even to those ideologies, are going to engage in violence. And let's keep that in mind. We're talking about a fringe here of all of these political movements. But, yeah, these individuals can get it into their head. Whether we call them disturbed or whether we call them ideological, that sometimes is a very difficult judgment to make. And sometimes they don't survive the incident, and we don't have them around for a court case or any other kind of investigation to explore further what was going through their minds.
Well, there might also be another way to filter it and say, was it an act that was deliberated by a group that was perpetrated to enact a particular political a set of principles? In other words, there was a chain of command involved, and whether or was it an individual who embraced this ideology and went off on their own without receiving an order?
Well, these days there's this large gray area where you have organizations that say, no, we wouldn't engage in violence. We're not no command control structure, but they say things that then inspire people to engage in violence. Now, noticeably, with Islamic revolutionary organizations, there's been a shift. So Al-Qaeda liked to do command and control, but the Islamic State has given up on training people or doing elaborate plots. They're just tweeting. They're putting things out there, say, go do whatever you want on your own. We'll take credit if we can. But they're not trying to organize these things in the same way that Al-Qaeda did. And so we're seeing individuals, some of them with, you know, disturbed in one way or another, doing stuff in the name of the Islamic State, but really not being part of any organized group.
Well, there was a distinct difference in your study between rural and urban law enforcement agencies. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, urban agencies reported higher levels of threat from all sorts of strands of violent extremism than rural agencies. But the relative numbers remained the same, so that even in urban agencies, anti-government extremism was more commonly cited as one of the top three threats, and more often than Islamic extremism.
You also had an op-ed piece in the New York Times that details a lot of the information from the assessment. But one of the final points you make is that, in fact, terrorist activity of all kinds is really only a tiny portion of the violence in America.
I think it's worth keeping that in mind, that we experience over 14,000 murders each year in the United States. And since September 11th, 2001, we've had over 200,000 murders in the United States. That's a huge death toll. Violent extremism, political violence, terrorism, whatever label you put on it, accounts for far less than 1% of all of these things in recent years. It's not the leading threat to public safety these days, fortunately.
And by far, the vast majority of those homicides were committed by guns. So the availability of guns has led to an unsafe environment for all of us. 200,000 is a lot of people to die, most of whom were shot to death on the streets of America. And yet, as you say, because they're not spectacular and they don't they're not attached to any kind of political ideology, they don't really get linked together. We don't connect the dots in the same way.
Yeah, I think that the narrative of every time there you see a Muslim American engaging in one of these plots of violence, it gets linked to this broader narrative of America being under siege overseas, these threats that are very real, these civil wars that are raging in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere. The fear that that's going to spill over here, these little incidents, now I don't mean to minimize some of them, could be quite dangerous, but they play into this broader global narrative and they become part of the story. Whereas other violence, it seems, doesn't and doesn't get the kind of coverage or attention.
Charles Kurzman is one of the co-authors of the report Law Enforcement Assessment of Violent Extremism Threat, and he will stay with us as we continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The debate continues over whether to call the Charleston church shootings an act of terrorism. The suspect in the killings is a single individual, and news coverage of the case shines a light on the increase in politically motivated crimes committed by lone gunmen. Joining us to discuss this is Southern Poverty Law Center's Mark Poduck. Mark is the co-author and editor of a report entitled Age of the Wolf, the study and the rise of the lone wolf and leaderless resistance terrorism. Mark, welcome to the State of Things.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Charles Kurzman is still with us, a professor of sociology at UNC. So can you explain for the purposes of your study the term lone wolf? What does it mean?
Well, it basically means someone who acts in some political attack on their own. They are not being controlled by someone else. They're not taking their orders from someone else. They're not being financed by other people. And they generally are not telling anyone around them what they're planning to do. So they're lone actors. And for obvious reasons, that makes them the very hardest kind of attackers to prevent in advance. If you're not a large conspiracy, the chances are very small that law enforcement are going to hear about your plans in advance.
And when you talk about political, this is a very broad spectrum of activity or ideas that you're talking about, right?
That's right. I mean, motivated by some kind of ideology, you know, in whole or in part, you know, whether that be white supremacist or any one of a number of other stripes of political opinion.
So do we have any sense that this is the idea of the lone gunman, certainly the phrase, I remember it from the Kennedy assassination. That's how far back the term goes in my imagination. I'm guessing it goes back farther than that. The rise of this political actor, the lone wolf, do we know if there's a trend?
Well, what we found in our own study, what we did was we looked at 63 incidents over more or less the past 6 years, most of the time that Barack Obama has been president. What we found was that of those 63 incidents, 74% were carried out, at least apparently, by lone wolves, people acting entirely on their own. When you looked at pairs, and typically those pairs were father and son, a pair of brothers, a couple of friends, a man and his girlfriend, that kind of thing, the count was up to 90%. Let me say that I don't think that this is a trend that began 5 years ago. I mean, we've been moving in this direction for probably 30 years. There was a kind of Klan theoretician, a man named Louis Beam, who wrote about this in the 80s initially and republished what became a very influential essay in 92 called Leaderless Resistance. Beam was reacting to having been one of 24 defendants in a huge trial case the federal government brought against leading white supremacists in this country. The government alleged a very large conspiracy to create a particular group, the Order, which murdered several people, stole about $4 million from armored cars and so on. The case fell apart. All of the defendants were acquitted. But afterwards, Beam really started to push this idea of leaderless resistance, saying quite sensibly that, you know, when we are in these large pyramidical structures, the arrest or the turning informant of a single person can destroy an entire large organization. Therefore, we need to move forward with what he called leaderless resistance. And what he was mainly talking about were very small cells of people, up to six people, who would act on their own, simply reacting to events in the news, to political developments, without coordinating in any way with one another. Included in that idea was essentially the lone wolf idea of people, you know, single person acting all alone.
So that suggests certainly some intention and premeditation and the idea of creating these this kind of violence without culpability, without group culpability. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say I'm not sure if, people out there are following Beam's guidelines or if they're simply reacting to reality. Because the reality is that just what he said is true. I mean, you are extremely likely to be caught if you're engaged in a larger conspiracy. Of those 63 incidents we looked at, only one could be described as the actions of a group, where a whole group of people got together and met almost literally in smoky rooms and decided that certain people needed to die. A comparison, it seems to me, is thinking about the civil rights movement period, 54 to 1968, in which, in fact, a lot of the Klan violence directed at civil rights workers and so on was planned by groups or was ordered from the leader of a particular Klan group. So things have changed fairly dramatically that way. And although I think Charles Kurtzman knows far more about this than I do, it seems to me that even when you look at jihadist violence in this country, it is also moving pretty heavily in the direction of lone wolf terrorism. As Charles said, that really is how ISIS works. We saw that pretty dramatically in the two jihadists who attacked the Draw Muhammad event a month or two ago in Garland, Texas, the two attackers who were killed. They seem to have been radicalized entirely via the internet.
Now, your study, as you said, looked at 63 incidents between 2009 and 2015. While we're on the subject, how many of them were carried out by anyone, either Muslim extremists or those inspired by Muslims?
I don't have the count in front of me, but I think it was seven or eight cases. It was a very small minority of cases.
Does this lone wolf phenomenon make things more complicated, more difficult for law enforcement?
I think without any question. If these people really don't talk to anyone, if they're not in bars bragging to their girlfriends or whoever, then it's quite unlikely that they're going to come to light in advance of the attack. I think that seems really clear.
And what about the just trying to analyze this? I mean, I think this is one of the quandary we're in, and in a way what generated this program. Just the difficulty of talking about what is terrorism and what isn't, what is political violence and what isn't. I mean, even for the purposes of your survey, did you find it difficult to sort of sort out, what you meant by that?
Well, we wrote a little section toward the front of the report saying, look, these definitions are very squishy. We included a number of incidents, which probably a number of people wouldn't have. And these were incidents that were unplanned. The typical scenario being, some kind of right-wing ideologue is pulled over by a highway and reacts with extreme violence, murders a couple of police officers, that kind of thing. I must say that I feel like this discussion of terrorism and what is terrorism has become really politicized in the sense that the political right in this country, the kind of Fox News organizations of the world, are very given to saying again and again, whenever there is a neo-Nazi or a Klan or other kind of attack like the attack in Charleston, that these are crazy people. They're simply mentally ill. They got very into calling Dylan Roof drug-addled. And I think very much against the facts. I guess one could argue that anyone who carries out any of these kinds of acts has something wrong with their head. But I think that is diminishing the very real fact that there's a real ideology out there. I mean, when you look at white supremacy or white nationalism in the United States, there's a very well-developed ideology. There are a lot of groups out there discussing this kind of material. you know, whatever, however mentally ill or not Dylann Roof may have been, the reality is that he got his ideas by discovering a particular website, the website of the Council of Conservative Citizens, which is a reincarnation of the old White Citizens Councils. And that seems very clear in almost all of these cases. So I don't understand it when the FBI director says he doesn't know whether he can call the attack on Emmanuel American African Methodist Church terrorism. I mean, it seems to me obviously terrorism. Roof, allegedly, wanted to start a race war. He was motivated by a real ideology, a set of false facts, I would argue, as it happens, the idea that white people are being subjected to genocide in the United States and so on. But the man was acting for political reasons.
I wonder if that – I mean, I guess obviously for the purposes of court proceedings, intent is everything. So knowing what was on the mind of the killer is critical. But in terms of effect, for all of us trying to analyze this, the effect of the act is terrorism. A civilian population has been told that they, for reasons of birth, are targeted for death. That has a chilling
effect.
So
it's every similarly
situated. So the effect is terrorism, period.
Mm-hmm. It's every similarly situated person. So if someone burns a cross on the lawn of the interracial couple's house someplace, well, everyone who is similarly situated, every other interracial couple within shouting distance is, in a sense, terrorized. It might be them next. And clearly you see that now. With what's happening with the church burnings around the South. I mean, there's no particular evidence to show that any of them are racially motivated arsons, although they might be. I'm not saying they're not. But African-American congregations, especially around the Deep South, are terrorized. They are taking extra security measures and so on. And yet there is this kind of political will out there, it seems to me, to really ignore it. And I said earlier on the political right, but a few months ago there was a CVE, a Countering Violent Extremism conference at the White House hosted by the president, and much was made before the meeting of all kinds of terrorism would be discussed and so on. But in the event, it was all Islamic terrorism, all Islamist terrorism all the time. Essentially nothing else was discussed, and that's a shame.
Charles Kurzman is still with us, a professor of sociology at UNC. Charles Kurzman?
I think one of the concerns that groups have is that they will be labeled terrorists or potential terrorists if some fringe in their community engages in violence. We've seen targeting of Muslim American communities for extra scrutiny, for law enforcement surveillance, and as well as for hostility, even sometimes from their neighbors, because of the actions of a tiny fringe proportion of that community that's engaged in violence. I think now what we're seeing after the horrible Charleston shootings is folks on the right concerned that they are going to be targeted for the acts of a small number of individuals who may have emerged from that community.
Well, and a lot of that happens through the media, so I want to bring Kenny Irby into the conversation right now. Kenny is at the Poynter Institute. He's a senior faculty of visual journalism and diversity, and he's going to talk about the appropriate use of media, how we come up with these terms and how we define what is and what isn't terrorism. Kenny Irby, welcome to the State of Things. Good to talk with you.
It's great to be here. It's a fascinating conversation that I think we all have to acknowledge that absolutely the use of the term and the history of the term is evolving and changing. And the very nature of these kinds of acts are to create major violence in a community and to instigate fear. And so we've seen that happen very clearly when the reports of African Americans in churches and places of worship are saying they're hunting us in our own places of worship. That's evidence of fear that speaks to the fact that not only is the term and these issues politically laden, but they're also emotionally charged in ways that the media needs to be responsible and accountable for defining the term as we move forward in reports across multiple media.
Do you have any protocols, pointers, suggestions, or really rules about how to define and how to use this term and when to use it?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, the history that we're looking at is very much an evolving history that in after the 9/11 bombings became much more of a topical conversation where, as several of our colleagues have already outlined, it was mostly a historic a view that, that the attacks were from externally upon Americans on the homeland. And now, increasingly, we began to see that these the attacks of terrorism, where these are large acts being perpetrated against innocent people, are happening from within. And so we advise that that media organizations minimize the harm of sensationalism and offer practical insights about how the term is being used, the number of people that have been injured, and as much as we know about the perpetrator and the incidents as they evolve.
Well, and I think you point out, too, that that we in the media fall into the trap of using the terminology that's often put out there by people who have an agenda.
Exactly.
You can remember Ronald Reagan talking about freedom fighters who are committing as much political violence in their own country as the enemy that we were allegedly fighting. And if you adopt the word freedom fighter for people who are slaughtering innocents in their own village and who we're supporting, you're on the wrong side of history, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that has become very much a cliched debate, particularly in social media and on the internet, that one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. And so I think what media organizations, credible media organizations, because there's a wide swath of media now that's mostly entertainment and pundit-led, but the actual reporting gives a great opportunity to contextualize and to clarify the use of the term and the appropriateness.
Charles Kurzman?
I wonder, Mr. Irby, which for journalists, how they decide which incident merits coverage and which don't. It seems to me that that when Muslims are arrested for some sort of plot of violence, it gets mentioned in the national news, but many of these right-wing plots don't seem to get that sort of attention.
I think you're correct, and history bears that out in lots of the reports that we are presented with here at the Institute, bear that fact out. And so the accountability then comes to the leadership of media organizations. And one of the challenges is that there's such a wide range of motivations and coverage. And so a lot of what we're seeing actually comes through the wire services, through Associated Press and Reuters and Bloomberg. And because in so many instances, newsrooms have been reduced and downsized so much that they're taking a great deal of their coverage from the wire feeds and trying to localize them.
Do you think the media organization should look at their own definitions, look at a definition of terrorism, which is holding causing harm to a civilian population to cause fear, and then apply that so that, because you talked also about not using inflammatory language, not doing harm. If you take a look at the church shootings and say, clearly that's what's at stake here, so I as a media organization, I'm going to call this a terrorist act. It's so obvious to me that it caused fear because of the killings of civilians. That's a good definition. Or am I complicit? Am I contributing to this kind of fear-mongering by using the term, by my own definition?
I think absolutely. We do encourage media organizations to examine self-censor themselves to the extent that they're evaluating or to self-analyze themselves with style guides to look at previous incidents and patterns and trends. One of the challenges, though, in the current scenario at Mother Emanuel is that this does open up a gaping wound in the Deep South and across America that African Americans have been under the attack and the sense of fear from day one, for lynching, from being hunted, and these kinds of scenarios are real, and we haven't acknowledged that in the history of media coverage. Maybe to some extent in oral history and narrative, but for America to embrace the horrors of the terrorism perpetrated by structured racism.
Well, I want to thank all of you for contributing to this conversation. Kenny Irby is Senior Faculty of Visual Journalism and Diversity at the Poynter Institute. Charles Kurzman, one of the co-authors of the report, Law Enforcement Assessment of the Violent Extremist Threat, also teaches sociology at UNC. Mark Podak is a Senior Fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, co-author and editor of Age of the Wolf, the study of the rise of lone wolf and leaderless resistance terrorism. Thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, One Black Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. Stay tuned to The State of Things.